the name of the values that keep you alive, do not let your vision of man be distorted by the ugly, the cowardly, the mindless, and those who have never achieved his title. Do not lose your knowledge that man's proper estate is an upright posture, an intransigent mind, and a step that travels unlimited roads. Do not let your fire go out, sparked by replacing the spark in the hope the swamps of the approximate are not quite, the not yet, the not at all. The world you desired can be won. It exists. It is real. It is possible. It's yours.
Welcome back to the Crypto Economy Podcast. My name is William Harris. I'm the editor-in-chief of the Atlas Digest and Crypto Economy News, and I'm here with the co-CEO of Crypto Economy Incorporated, Enrique Sotomayor. Enrique, how's it going?
Hey, pretty well. Excited to be on.
Cool. So Enrique outlined this podcast episode. What we're going to do, we're going to kind of go into the backstory of memetics and epigenetics and discover how the ideas kind of infect humans and inform the environments in which we operate and behave. So Enrique, if you want to go ahead and get right into it, just go ahead. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. So
getting first with, like, the little new story background of the week.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. So to begin with, we just wanted to go over some, there's been a lot of headlines this week, obviously. So we just wanted to go over a couple of them and give our take. So to begin with, Trump welcomes three American prisoners released from North Korea ahead of June 12th summit. A lot to say on this. So
It's like Trump is, I really don't understand Trump's role in the Korean issue. I guess I don't want to say Korean conflict because it's more of a resolution now, but Trump seems to be given credit by the South Korean president, but he's kind of a leftist in the sense that he doesn't want to impose his capitalistic economy onto North Korea when they reunify, right? So he might just be understanding Trump and saying, like, well, I'm going to get what I want if I give Trump the credit, right? What do you think about that?
I'm not too sure. So the only things that I've read about is part of the negotiation that North Korea is leaning for is for America to pull all of its military out of South Korea. Apparently, we seem to be signaling that we're willing to do that. If we've scheduled the summit talk in Singapore, I think there's a lot of research to do on this that could be interesting for the next Q podcast, because I have been following somewhat along with Q, and he did post 56 days ago today, saying hostages would be released 55, and then 55 days later the hostages were released. So yesterday was a big day for all the people.
Okay, so these are hostages that were taken. Was it on inauguration day or the day before inauguration?
January 21st. So some of these people have been detained since 2015. Some of these people have been detained longer than others. I think the official term they're using is prisoners, not hostages.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. These are.
I guess hostage implies that they're requesting something and allowing them to be released.
Yeah.
Upon some precondition.
Apply some. Yeah. So I remember, like, Trump.
Exactly, yeah. So Trump has really, I don't know if he can take credit for all the releases, but it seems like all of this, like, scheduled releases of the announced ones, even the one of Otto Warmbier, who tragically died when he came back, but he was still released. Those all seem to have happened under Trump's administration, if I'm not incorrect. I don't know if Obama really had any success in that area. He seemed to be really not ignorant of North Korea in the sense that he didn't know about it, but in the sense that it wasn't on his radar, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, this is actually fascinating. I think we can highlight a lot of the administration differences with some of the tweets that have been coming out in light of what's going on in North Korea right now. So Trump is really the big stick the big stick president. He's big talk. Trump was very, Obama was very good with people we are already allied with. He was very good with the Gulf states. He was very good with Europe. But what good is that? We're already allies with them. The Asian states, if you look at, like, the Filipino president, all these people, like, it's a big stick dominates that game. You have to be willing to, like, draw a line in the sand, and people have to respect you in order not to cross that line. I think Obama drew the line in the sand literally a couple times. People crossed it. He never really responded. So the relationship with Asian affairs sort of deteriorated second term for Obama, in my opinion, because of his inability to stick up to what he claimed he was going to do in Syria.
Yeah, Exactly, yeah. So all of his red lines were really just pencil marks, right? Because he just kept revising them and defining the words around them and shifting the Overton window that surrounded them as well.
Right, so like, Trump comes in and Trump starts being the big stick president. Trump comes in and starts tweeting, like, I don't know, all the stuff about Rocket Man like, or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. It's like it's a bully pulpit at its zenith, and as well as the big stick policy. So he leverages the bully pulpit at home, but in foreign policy seems to exhibit the kind of, or demonstrate the kind of respect that he lacks for the other politicians within the country, as he does with the foreign leaders. So he's really respectful to, I think, Shinzo Abe. I feel like they have a really good relationship that's kind of demonstrated in the photos. Whereas Obama's foreign policy and his pivotage were kind of defined by an apology tour, right? Because they wanted to go apologize for European and Western and American imperialism. Like, oh my gosh, America owned the Philippines at some point. We got to pay for that now, even though they're not asking for it. So it's that kind of environment or mold that you go in when you approach meetings with foreign leaders doesn't seem to be especially productive when you're requesting disarmament or something. Like, diplomacy is really good in the European perspective, where we just want to rid ourselves of any sort of violent impositions. But when applying it to these countries that still use big stick foreign policies, as you said, it becomes really ineffectual because, I mean, you can't just convince somebody with words to abandon their goals and plans.
Yep, so, that's
why. With that said, what do you...
I think it was pretty funny. I saw Ben Rhodes tweeting out, like, I think maybe back in November or something, a while ago now, but at the climax of the whole Trump tweets at Mr. Rocket Man, Ben Rhodes tweeted, for every time like there's an insult thrown from Trump to Kim Jong-un, diplomacy becomes less possible. it's interesting. That really highlights the previous administration's whole like view on the big stick policy. It's like, well, no, we have to be respectful every time we even break away from this trajectory of respect, then we're encouraging we're leading to the downfall of diplomacy.
Okay, that's a really good point. I think that's a good idea to way to segue into the Iran deal. So Iran deal kind of is the epitome of a negotiation where one approached the stage that had the leverage, which is the United States, but we approached it and had an equal playing field with Iran, as supposing and presupposing that they had the same kind of moral ambitions and outcomes desired that as we did, right? And so that really shaped the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Iran deal. And now Trump is going in and dismantling it, and it seems like all the supporters of Trump lie in the Middle East, like Saudi Arabia and Israel, the ones that would be actually affected if the balance of power to be leveled with a terrorist-supporting state. So what are your thoughts on that? Particular thoughts on the Iran war? I mean, like, European powers support the deal, which is kind of like representative of their aim for diplomacy, which really can't even be affected in real life.
Yep. I mean, the whole geopolitics of that area are so complicated. Iran is one of Russia's biggest allies, and I feel like this whole Syria, Iran, all this chaos that we're going through is just a really complicated proxy Cold War. We're still really just fighting with Russia in just different lands. Pulling out of this Iranian deal, I think like the markets really didn't respond, so it was kind of already priced in. So a lot of people felt that it was coming. Trump said like, announcements coming in 3 days or something like that. So like he teased it up. He like hyped it up. Like, you're not gonna set a firm deadline like that just to say, oh yeah, we're not pulling out.
Yeah, exactly. So like, do you think this was the intention the whole time, as he promised the campaign? Because I guess he really couldn't say anything about it until it seems like he was actually waiting for Netanyahu to release the documents. Because I think he actually he was told before they were gonna be released, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So
he was made aware of it. Americans confirmed it, and then Netanyahu came out into the public and released
it. Do you think they're trying to start something? Like, what do you think? Do you think it's as bad as they say it is? I mean, Iran clearly had these programs, right?
Yeah, I do think it was a huge mistake by the previous administration to just send pallets full of cash in the final days of Obama's reign. I think the whole... I don't know, it was really sketchy. I don't think it was very democratic. So I didn't like the Iran deal to begin with, but I don't want to get involved in a war. So, and I feel like a war with Iran is World War III. But if it's just Israel and Iran, I feel like Israel could like sweep Iran. Israel's got, I don't know, like 100 hydrogen bombs.
Jeez, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Israel's. I
mean, considering the arrangements seem to be playing out in the form of Syria, Iran, and Russia versus like Saudi Arabia, Israel, United States, I think that would be an interesting conflict. I've been listening to Ben Shapiro, and he's been kind of the first one who predicted that there's a tinderbox in the Middle East that we've all been ignoring for a while, and it was basically Iran versus Israel. And he was, I think he was really proven right. So,
yeah, Iran is the wasp nests. If you look at a map, you have Afghanistan and Iraq on either side of Iran, and it, like, most Americans probably don't even know that, but Iran is the wasp nest, and we've been trying to stomp out these little fires on the outside, and I feel like we're finally getting to the wasp nest.
Yeah, I remember, wasn't there a list for which Bush and Hillary were criticized to be following or included, like Iraq, like you say, all the states around it, and it's kind of like a domino. We're trying to get to the last one,
yep.
And Iran, Syria being the one before Iran, but is Iran the last one, or is there one after that? I guess it would be
Russia.
I
feel like with the support of Saudi Arabia, the final domino would be Iran. Saudi Arabia wants to dismantle Iran, whether that's politically or materialistically, but Saudi Arabia has been seeming to move along a much more secular trajectory than Iran, and the more fundamentalists in Iran are really threatening the stability of the region. So I feel like the biggest threat to the West in that area is Iran. And we're using Syria as a proxy battleground for there.
Okay, yeah, so I guess we just hope that it remains a proxy battle. I mean, I really agree that Saudi Arabia transitioning into, I guess, a modern state, because it really wasn't before in the years prior. I think that kind of really tipped the balance towards this newfound alliance between the West and Israel and Saudi Arabia. And I think is it the UAE alongside them, or
the
Qatar?
UAE and Bahrain and Qatar.
Okay.
And
definitely not Yemen, I guess. Yeah, I don't think Yemen would be on the side of Saudi Arabia, but I'm not sure about that. So continue on, would you want to hit the next topic?
Yeah, let's see. Attorney General Eric Schneiderman resigns amidst allegations of inappropriate behavior that include
he captured a girl, right?
So some of the allegations were that, like, some of the ladies that he'd been having relationships with, they came forward and claimed that they were victims of unsolicited violence during sex. He would, like, beat them, or he was just into some weird stuff. And most of these women felt like they really couldn't come forward with it because he's in such a position of power. But then after the Harvey Weinstein Me Too movement, this attorney general really started doing everything he could to try to prosecute Weinstein and, like, publicly fight the Me Too front battle as well. And Samantha Bee came out and said, "This is the man we need." Like, so it's pretty funny that the left picked the wrong man yet again.
Yeah, it seems to be happening a lot. I think they also fall into the mistake of not wanting to distance themselves. I mean, it seems like they've learned that, though, because they quickly established that barrier.
Yeah, I feel like the right is susceptible to this, too. People just fall in love with celebrities, and celebrities aren't necessarily... And this isn't a celebrity, right? This is a politician, but don't bet on somebody else when you can fight your own battles.
Yeah, exactly. They're not supposed to be our leaders. They're supposed to be our delegates. They're supposed to represent us there. We're not supposed to be fawning over them.
So some of the allegations include forcing this lady to call... Let's see, it says, calling a lady his brown slave, demanding she
color,
repeat...
Right?
Yeah, demanding she repeat that she's his property.
Jesus.
There was four similar accusations made within 2 days. Snyderman resigned 3 hours after the publication. So I guess the one good thing about the Me Too movement has been we've really highlighted the need for more checks in big government. All these powerful people really do have the power to tap your phone, do whatever they want. So if there's people who are this violent with the people around them, who do you go to? How do you get the voice out of the community? So I'm actually pretty happy that this guy resigned.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like it's actually really been really effective. I mean, there are some missteps, just as with any activist movement. Like, there are huge missteps with the Tea Party.
Right.
I mean, obviously, the Tea Party incorporated some really bad elements to it, and it unfortunately began to define it. And I think that's what the right does with the left as well. I mean, everybody wants to box in and define the window of accepted opinion. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been overall good.
One of the biggest problems with it is the fact that a lot of people are guilty until proven innocent.
Exactly.
But one of the best things is people can no longer defend themselves by using their politics or using their career to say, like, oh, look, I gave so many jobs to women. I'm a champion of minorities. Like, these accusations with my personal life, yeah, that's personal. That's no longer a viable excuse. Now we're saying, like, oh, like, really, what matters is your personal actions, how you carry yourself day to day, and the fact that you have all these you have all like this track record of your politics defending women, that means nothing. You're still violating.
Exactly, yeah. And I know a lot of people fall into the trap of just saying, like, oh, why don't you just, if it's so bad, you need to come out with it as soon as it happens. But it's like, I think there's one good point to make, that we don't really know what that situation is like. Because I know that if I'm pursuing a career of fame, like, exactly, yeah, I've never experienced that. And two, like, if I would do anything, really, if I was on a trajectory that was really important like that. So, I mean, the idea that Matt Lauer can get away with having
really,
a button.
Like, ponder this and, like, realize what you've done. Like, you're acting out these things that you don't necessarily know what you're doing. And then it takes some retrospection to really understand, like, wow, I was taking advantage of there. Like, wow.
Like, that's what I was wondering. Yeah, do they think they're fully aware of the fact, or do you think that they really don't know? Like,
so I would assume for the most part that you kind of understand that you're going into this game and you do the dance, but like maybe there are some escalations of like intimacy that feel a little more natural, and it's like, okay, was that, does he like me, or was that some power move? Like, I feel like there's room for confusion, but for the most part I would assume people go into these situations with people of power who are known to take advantage of other people, sort of knowing that it's likely something to happen.
Yeah, this, and another thing that I often think
about. But that's not at all saying that, like, I'm like the victim knew that they were exposing themselves to that. That's not what I'm saying.
Oh yeah, no. Well, it's like the nature of their position is one that's predicated on that dominance hierarchy, right, or that position of power. So like, you, in order to be in that position that you seek, you have to, I guess, give up authority of your own decision making to some higher person in the company. And I guess like the example I'm using is Matt Lauer. Like, he's the senior anchor, whatever his position was,
right?
And I just my question is, like, how aware are people in the environment of these things going down, right? So does anybody notice that Matt Lauer has a button that just closes his door? Is that what the button did? Like, how aware are his coworkers?
That'd be just pure speculation, but I would assume that like these things are like unspoken secrets that you just know, like, oh yeah, that guy, I mean, okay, he's above my pay grade, but yeah, that guy's a creep.
Yeah, exactly. And I do like the effects of the Me Too movement erasing people from the public record, essentially, when they've committed these crimes. I think
that's fascinating. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, like, people tend to just mull over and try to, like, you know, regurgitate the news all the time and try to analyze in a new perspective and find some new discovery that was previously unknown. But I feel like the media needs to focus on a new direction where, instead of publishing manifestos of shooters, you just don't talk about them. You just cut it off. It's not part of the public scope. It's not a meme anymore. Yep. Right? You cut the head off the meme. So, segueing into that.
Yeah, actually, that's a big
topic we can talk about, is some memetics. So,
that's perfect.
Yeah. Enrique here is an expert on memes. He's like, I consider him my teacher in the world of memes. So, why don't you go ahead and take it away?
Yeah, so I didn't understand why I was so fascinated by Twitter. I started like browsing Twitter, seeing all these funny images, seeing how people abstract arguments and use just certain types of points you can make in an argument and make it more abstract and use it in different types of arguments. So that's what first got me interested in this idea of memes. And then I started studying it a little more and found out that the term meme is actually older than the internet. It was first termed by Richard Dawkins when referring to, let's see, it says originally termed the phrase meme in reference to replicating ideas. So
yeah, I think it's a combination of the word memos for Greek of knowledge, I believe, and then genetics, or like genome, the meme part, but like genes, or I guess genomes, I believe is the word, would be like the passing on of knowledge through the chromosomes or through genomes. Yeah, stuff is very complicated.
We live in a world full of like Rick Rolls and Dap Boys and Dabs, and memes have really evolved in the last couple of years from being this thing that we couldn't even agree how to pronounce. To the whole reason that like we get on social media. So memes are really the value proposition of Facebook, I would argue. Like, what is a meme? That's sort of where I want to begin. So a meme, I would define it as a cultural idea or unit that spreads within a community without genes being involved. So that's the key point. We can spread memes. Ideas can hijack your brain. That's a famous quote by Daniel Dennett.
Right, so the idea that you don't develop ideas personally, they're just regurgitations, but new adaptations of old ideas that have been historically proven to be true in a different sense that science proves things to be true. Is that right?
Yep, yep. Okay. So we didn't just evolve to spread our genes, but we also evolved to spread our memes. It is just as important that we spread our ideas. than that we spread our genes. And actually a lot of like human biology, once you understand this, it starts to make sense. Like, why are our heads so big? Surely if our heads were smaller, there'd be less complications during birth for both the child and the mother. If we really only evolved to spread our genes, like, couldn't we have smaller heads and increase the amount of human life out there? But the fact that like we also care about spreading our memes, well, now we need a bigger head. So this starts to make a little bit of sense. So memes replicate just like genes, and memes have to compete with other memes for their survival. When we say it's like a gene, we mean it quite literally, like in a scientific sense.
And it's not, and yeah, it's like not selected by any sort of, I guess, controlled process. It's public consensus, but people don't even know. They're just voting with their eyes, basically.
Yeah, and people don't necessarily know why they're spreading the meme.
Like every time I see a new meme, I'm always like, okay, well, how did that originally start? I mean, I can always see traces of various old branches of memes in all the new memes that I see, but I always wonder, okay, where did that originally start? You know, it has to be, but it really didn't. I think that's the answer. It never really starts. It's always been there.
Yep. So like a meme might be a very good way, an image. When I'm saying meme now, I'm not necessarily talking about the scientific meme, but I'm talking about the thing that we share on Twitter. So a meme might express an emotion that's common amongst many people, but they don't have a better articulated version of it. So for instance, I'm thinking of that girl behind the counter that's like a fast food restaurant who's like sticking her neck and her hand out, and she's just like, what do you want? I'm thinking of that meme, and when I think of myself, I'm like, I'm in situations sometimes where I feel that expression, but I cannot articulate it. So memes are the perfect way to express certain emotions that we cannot put into words. And platforms, we live in this network society, that which is the perfect petri dish for memes to spread. The information age has spread up the evolutionary process of memes by probably 1,000x, I would say.
Right, and do you think the last 2 years ago, 2016, played a really crucial role in how fast it was expedited? I mean, it seemed to be like the memes really came onto the front page, the fact that like, Washington Post was writing articles about them and how weird they were.
Yeah, definitely. So there's a lot of crossover between archetypes and memes. So when something embodies like the most abstract version of that thing, that's like the archetypal version of it, that it cannot get more abstract, it cannot get better than that one. So the frog is sort of like archetypally seen as this thing that lives between categories. And then Pepe and Keck and all these things started popping up during the election in 2016. And it was fascinating to watch how we started acting something out that we didn't necessarily consciously know what we were doing, and it just made perfect sense, like in hindsight, looking back at it.
In what way? Like, go into how it acted out. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so people started sharing the meme of Pepe the Frog. And some people get called something, and the right started embracing it. The term is embrace the meme. So you call somebody a racist, they start embracing it. You call them xenophobic, you call them this, you call them that. They just own it, and they put it in a meme. So that the next time you call them it, well, the image is right there, and like there's nothing, and I just get frustrated, and I just start getting into my feelings. So that was one of the tactics that I saw during the election. I saw people using memes, using specifically the Pepe meme, to infuriate people by just embracing whatever it is they were being accused of being.
Exactly, and I think that's how Trump found his success. I think to be a perfect meme, you cannot be aware of the fact that you are, and so that's how he was so perfectly representative of that, because he basically just
not necessarily you don't have to be aware, but it has to be uncertain whether he's unaware or not.
Okay, that's fair, yeah.
So he might be aware, but as long as, like, we're like, wait, like, he's a 70-something-year-old, is he aware?
It's like Schrodinger's box, you just ruin it if you open it. You can't, you got it, the uncertainty is the chaos that fuels the order of the memes.
Definitely.
Ever since that last episode with Justin, he presented some ideas that I'd, like, really never heard, and I've been mulling them over for a long time, basically stuck in this thought loop, so... I'm looking forward to really continuing that discussion. I think that was a great discussion. Memes is just, I remember first getting and I don't want to say getting into memes, that just sounds like such a normie thing to say, but it's basically like, you really don't, there's really no day and night thing. You just start seeing these, and like your specific interpretation of memes depends on when you started and like what kind of prehistory, not like sort of knowledge you have of the available memes at the time you started, right? Because like every meme that you enjoy is really just a permutation of a meme before it. So like, I guess it really defines, it's a good way of encoding your own personality in a form of like a mimetic library, if that makes sense. Like,
right.
I can definitely scroll, I can scroll through my photo library and just see the like the ideologies I've kind of embodied throughout time as I like the memes change.
And it's not even like embodied, yeah. You might not even necessarily agree with them, but they caught your attention for some reason you couldn't express and you just shared it or saved it or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Like the kind of knowledge that shapes your behavior. I mean, I know that's like what you kind of know a lot about psychoanalysis, I think.
Yeah.
Where it's, you're kind of, yes, yeah, so we can go through that really. I think you had some ideas on that.
Yeah. So I just have a couple more things that I wrote down about memes that
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
So one of the points that I wanted to make was 2016, or the whole election cycle, really, there was like something up in the air. So it wasn't like every other time. So people started like pushing out memes. Some like 4chan, for instance, was crazy with all the Pepe stuff, all the different permutations with Pepe. So the half-life, or like the how sticky a random meme is, like was decreasing. So they had like shorter lives. I mean, shorter shelf lives.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Before they had to adapt to new current events, right? Because the window was okay. I see what you're saying. The news cycle was so sped up.
Something else is that like, mimetic replication is super rare across animal kingdoms. Some animals are very good at like learning from observation, but almost none are as good as humans. Whales can like learn how to mimic this, like the sounds of other whales. Some monkeys can learn how to use tools, but from, just based from simply watching other people. But I could probably show you how to do something, and you could do it like 9 times out of 10.
Right.
So I think this generalization of like, we have memes and genes, not just genes, and memes really help distinguish humans from the rest of the like animal kingdom. I think that's a valid point to make.
So, and then what you're talking about earlier with the idea that the human had to develop this larger brain, and that was over a course of a long time, when I guess I'm just wondering what was a catalyst for that. So
yeah, nobody really knows. So the like, brain yeah, size like, had doubled or like yeah. tripled, I think in 100,000 years or something. That's a super short time span evolutionarily. So nobody really has an answer for why or how the brain grew so fast. There's a lot of different theories out there, like the stoned ape theory.
I love that one.
Yeah. But nobody really knows why we have such big brains. So that's like a fascinating problem. And if you form a theory that helps explain that, well, then that might be a sticky theory.
It's like, because I think we have don't we have the longest nurturing period of any animal in our class, like any mammal?
Are there any longer than us?
And that's because, exactly, like you have to, it takes time to imprint all that information. I mean, we don't spend that, it's almost like our growth kind of evolved around that. So our growth is really, it depended on that long period of time. We grow until, I think, our mid-20s, I believe, and so does our brain. But I feel like this all might have been shaped all around the necessity of more information storage and processing. So like,
and how will that all change with the accessibility of this information, with the fact that we can look up this information? Will we still need these huge brains?
That's a good question. I guess if you, what's the point of having all that useless resources if you have a better way of interpreting information, or at least a
right,
better way
maybe,
of encoding it?
Maybe like from a macro perspective, we only evolved this big brain for a short-term time just so we can build the internet, just so we can have Alan Turing, and then whatever, have a system, builds like a network society that creates like an ecosystem where it's the ideal condition for ideas to travel and replicate, like we've seen today.
Okay, yeah, because I know Elon Musk talks about, but I feel like Elon Musk talks a lot about stuff that he really wants to know about, but kind of doesn't, so he like talks about the grand ideas that he believes in.
Right.
And so one thing he talks about is like that our thumbs are really low at, are really inefficient at transferring information. We type on mobile phones, so it's like, I don't know what it was, like 8 something bytes per second or something like that, or bits per second. And what's he implying there, that there's some sort of new novel form of information reception that we're going to develop, that we're going to put in our brains?
I would assume that he's trying to make the argument that like The bottleneck is really the output of information, not the input. So we can input a shit ton of information really fast, but how fast I can get an idea across to you if I'm having to text it out, there's a constraint there that we really have to bypass if we want to get be connected to these networks a lot closer.
I see. Okay. So he's just proposing that thought. Okay.
Yeah,
that
I think he calls thumbs meat sticks.
I mean, that's a pretty literal interpretation, but it's not untrue at all. So what would you? So you talked earlier about the like the distinction between archetypes and memes. Can you go into, further into that? Sorry. So memes are just representations of archetypes, or
yeah. So So I would say an archetype. So archetypes come from the Jungian archetypes. So I'll kind of take a step back. Broadly, the psychoanalysts or psychoanalysis, that's where Carl Jung got famous, and that's where Sigmund Freud got really famous studying. Psychoanalysis is a very romantic school of thought. This is actually related to something we talked about in the last podcast with Justin, where it's romantic in the sense that emotion and motivations are far more important than rationality. So we are making the argument that rationality isn't the highest virtue, that when you are highly rational, you tend to be very prideful and shell yourself off and don't want to expose yourself to uncertainty. So the psychoanalysts, they tend to not really believe you. When you tell them you're doing something because of a certain reason, they tend to be very cynical, very skeptical, and they believe that you really act out your truths. You don't necessarily articulate them, and you probably don't even understand them yourselves.
And real quick question, so do they believe that the truths can be interpreted, or they believe that there's no objective aspect to this truth that can be?
Yeah, so there's a distinction between Freud and Jung. So it's not I would say that Freud thought that you were actively suppressing these, or you didn't create the situation where these things can thrive. Carl Jung thought, no, you're not necessarily like suppressing these. You're not necessarily suppressing these truths, but maybe they're truths that have not yet come to be. So that was more of the way he understood the unconscious. The unconscious was a process. It's not done already. The truth has not yet come to be. So you're not necessarily suppressing it from yourself. You just aren't capable of understanding. It's not as if your mind is understanding something and then suppressing it and then deciding, hey, I'm not going to share this with a persona because he's too fragile. It's actually incapable of you understanding that truth. So that truth has not yet come to be within you.
So the truth does, but it does exist, but it's just not interpreted. It's incapable of being interpreted because is it always just like manifesting in form of behavior? Is that what he's arguing? The way that you're trying to understand is by manifesting it into behavior?
You need a large enough sample size to understand what it is that this person is doing. It requires a lot of time to really see, like you can tell me, hey, I'm doing this because of this, and then I'll watch you for years and years, and then I'm like, okay, well, I don't really understand. I don't really know whether I should believe his motivation or not, but I'm just going to watch the outcome and infer the motivation. And that's probably, you should trust that more than the motivation that was cited to you.
Okay, so basically, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So let me see. So the psychoanalyst, specifically Carl Jung, he believed that you exist within social constructs and artificial institutions. And you're only capable of making sense of the world because you lived within these confines. So you are only capable of making sense of the world because you're boxed in by society, and then within that you're boxed in by your body. And the reason we need to have limitations, the reason we have to be boxed in partially is because technically most of the universe is technically incomputable. For instance, like the world's fastest supercomputer is incapable of mapping out all the moves of chess.
Right, exactly. Like I remember I have a good buddy up in Pittsburgh who has worked with AI previously, and I mentioned him like, oh, it would be really cool to start a simulation of the Big Bang. And he's told me that he knows people that work on those, and with all the computers in NASA, they can only simulate the activities precisely of 100 particles or 100 constituent particles. So the idea that, I mean, I hear a lot of talk about simulation and that how it's certain, you know, there's no way to disprove it. which seems to me to be a red flag of any sort of hypothesis. The idea that the simulation is somehow right around the corner, I really don't think that it's even close. Like, we cannot even fathom how much power it would take to simulate something with the depth that it would take to produce a reality that we interpret. So, I mean, but I guess everything seems to be uniting in sort of like a philosophical singularity. You've got science moving toward the idea that nothing is real and that mass is only some number assigned by the Higgs field. Mm-hmm. And then you have society going into this postmodern decay of objectivity where everything is up for interpretation. And it seems like everything is sort of converging into this one, like, knowledge is really subjective at all levels, right? And kind of like a, yeah, would you say this is kind of like, what would you say caused this, really? And in that, maybe segue to Jordan Peterson and kind of how he cites to Carl Jung to explain his beliefs. That makes sense. Like,
yeah, so no, all these things are definitely connected. Yeah. I definitely think all these things are connected. Let me think.
So as somebody who, I personally don't know a lot about the Jungian archetypes, so maybe you can like define that or give a few examples to help people understand what that is, because I think it's kind of a complex thing to...
Yeah, so Carl Jung, he saw the individual not as a body, but more as a loose collection of spirits. So this led to the realization that you're not alone in your head, and a scary realization. And you can debate whether or not the space you inhabit is in your head, but the proposition that you're in charge, let alone alone, seems hard to believe. So he started to see the individual as like a collection of all these different spirits, and then these spirits can embody certain archetypes. For instance, examples of these archetypes are like the hero and villain archetypes, Superman, Lex Luthor, Jesus, Satan, whatever permutation of it. But the abstract story that we're telling is a hero villain archetype, or you could have like the wise king archetype, or like the evil what's like Scar from The Lion King, the evil like uncle. Then like Freud has some more, so these archetypes aren't unique to Jung, but they're just really abstract things that we tend to act out, that once you realize them, you might make yourself aware that you're actually acting it out yourself. So Freud was really into sexuality and aggression, and he studied like the Oedipal situation, which is where you're over nurturing, and you by your over nurturing nature cause the demise of your offspring. You're the reason why they never moved out of the basement. You were the one who never said no to them, and that's why they are who they are. So the archetypes can be used to understand like these loose collection of spirits, these different spirits. Think of it as like a room full of ghosts. That's a better representation for who you are than like a piece of meat and that's walking around. And there's different personalities. The you are when you're mad is not the same you are when you're happy. That's not the same you are when your back's pushed up against the wall. So once you understand that there's different yous, there's different versions of you, that, like, based on the situation you're in, you can use different means to control yourself. So the same tactics you might use to like alter your motivations when you're happy might not work on you when you're sad or depressed.
Okay, I see. So if I were to follow the 12 Rules of Life by Peterson, then I would become his archetypal good man, or a good citizen.
Maybe.
And then you've read his book. Have you read his book?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, you probably read it a while ago. Yeah, I just now got it. I have not gone a lot through it, but it's pretty good so far. I'm learning a lot of his interpretations of these archetypes. So he almost represents the Bible, Jordan Peterson does, as sort of a collection of archetypes or a collection of parables about. So it's almost a form of it's like a meme dictionary, really, in a sense. I mean, I really think that linking back to what you said about Freud and sexuality, I think the idea of being naked and being that being attributed to the original, I guess, onset of self-consciousness and self-awareness in the Bible. Being Adam, once he bites the fruit, he becomes aware of his own form, right? And so he becomes ashamed. And that is sort of what drives self-consciousness at its root, right?
Right. Yeah, no, that's a fascinating interpretation. It's the first book of the Bible, Genesis, and then like the first humans, or not even the first humans because they were made by God. I guess Cain and Abel are the first real humans, but the first man and woman on earth. And then the story about like how they bite an apple, and like we've been sharing this story with ourselves for thousands and thousands of years, and now we finally started to realize like, wow, this one story actually helps explain a lot of stuff. It explains like arrival of self-consciousness, and it also explains why humans see in color and why we have such good vision for the size of the animal that we are. Most animals with vision that's as precise as ours are probably like birds that have to use their vision to hunt things miles away. The reason the argument's been made that the reason that humans have the vision that we have and the reason that we see in color is all because the reason we see in color is because we've evolved to spot ripe fruit from like bad fruit. So because we're fruit eaters, we started seeing in color and we've evolved that mechanism. But because we were tree dwellers in the past, we really had to, at least the lower quarter of our visual cortex is really specialized at identifying rapid movement and specifically snakes. So our eyes are specialized at identifying snakes. So the snake and the apple help explain why our vision evolved. And then the vision in the Bible is like the very first thing that happens when he bites the apple is the scales fall off his eyes. So what a lot of people interpret that as meaning is like the animal, the reptilian part of him, that animal falls off. He now becomes a human. He becomes self-aware. And the very first thing he does is he covers himself. And then he not only covers himself, but he blames Eve. So he projects his insecurities and he blames the woman. And that's like the most archetypal man story ever.
Exactly, yeah.
He does exactly the opposite of what God told him to do. And then he blames the woman.
And then he blames God right after.
Yeah, and then he blames God, and then he's like, yeah. Oh.
So would it be too far of a reach to extend these kind of metaphors and apply them to what we see now in a modern society? Like, every time you see kind of an asshole on TV, an arrogant asshole, he's biting an apple, or like the snake of not representing knowledge for the Hippocratic symbol, like with the snake around the, is it the sword?
I think that's so where the real utility in these biblical stories is understanding them, abstracting them, and then looking for where we're embodying them. Or where others are embodying them because we know how they end up.
Okay, so essentially then what this argues then at the core is that all of our ideas started out as biological adaptations, or at least our own analysis or analyses of these adaptations. So is that, yeah.
So it would go a little further. So we'd say that it's not even our ideas. So people don't have ideas. Ideas have people. So there's no ownership of ideas. So these ideas evolved separately from our genes. These ideas evolved, and we've adapted certain ideas. And some ideas have served great utility and have been abstracted into stories and myths and things that we have in the background. Because we are humans that live such short lives, much of the truths that we know like are actually expressed through myths, and we actually share them culturally with ourselves, not through other means,
right?
But,
not
right.
Okay, and so you mentioned earlier that there are other animals that also express this or can relay information without passing it on through their offspring.
Yeah,
you said there was, or there, okay.
Yeah, so
it's not something that's unique to humans.
It's not unique to humans. So other animals are capable of learning via observation and then spreading that idea somewhere else. There are some examples of like apes learning or being taught something just by like being shown a video of like a human doing something, and then the ape will go out and do it. And another prominent example is whales being able to mimic each other's songs or pitches. I can learn from you, and then I can go along and carry this thing. So it's not something that I got from you because I'm a descendant of you and that was in your genes because it helped you survive, but it's something that I was able to pick up on. So I don't even require your genes anymore. So I think this could help make the argument that memes are a much more powerful evolutionary mechanism than genes, because the key point is that most of our evolutionary adaptations now occur outside of the genetic iteration. So they occur on like these intellectual conversations.
Yeah, okay, I see. They pass along by the form of stories and speech, which I guess is based on kind of like the foundation of Western philosophy, right? That God used speech to create existence, and so everything is relayed by communication at some level, like the... Yeah, I don't know if that makes sense, but
yeah,
that's just what I see. Yeah, good.
This is something that makes me. So I started thinking about this question after we finished the last podcast. So like we had this big distinction about the East and the West, and I started thinking like why do we draw those lines like between East and West? Why is it not like North and South, or why Like, why specifically East and West? And then, like, if you think of like the human origin stories, or the ones that at least are believed right now, like the fact that human life started in Africa and we moved from Africa, and maybe there's different tribes of human that started somewhere else, but if we really all did start in one place and then separated, that East and West line is sort of like the fork on the road. So at one point somebody decided, like, oh, this dualist approach, this dualist schema of the world is gonna serve us great means, and it's gonna make us a lot more likely to survive. So I'm gonna embody this schema. And then somebody else said, hey, yeah, but you expose yourself to all this anxiety when you're a materialist, and not instead I'm just gonna be this Buddhist, and I'm gonna think everything is one and I'm not separate from anything else. So I don't know,
Okay.
abstracting like the East and West to just being like a decision we each make, was something that I'd like to have a conversation with Justin about.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that interpretation. That's actually, you articulated something that I kind of failed to in that discussion. That was like, what is the essential division between these two? And where does that
Right.
come from? And does it imply that the division is real, or that they're part of the same thing? And I think that I was the whole time I was operating the assumption that there's some fundamental line between Eastern and Western, and that line exists in the fundamental nature of reality, being that one operates on a dualist like approach where existence is a gestalt of two halves that are like greater than each other as a sum of the parts,
Yeah,
right? And
I
so
think the
together they
line
work into this
between
like the yin
East and
yang.
West is just like the line between good and evil. It runs down the middle of every man's heart.
Exactly. So that was probably my fundamental point, is that there's always like a dual. I mean, maybe that's just me operating in sort of the bias of Western thought, where everything has a duality to it. And that's just my overall belief, is that
But if that's
how
the
far
case,
can we
can you
go?
ever achieve nirvana if you're built
Exactly.
into
Like how far?
a partition system?
Right. Like how far can you go? How many analogies can you make to understand something like that's kind of like running at the edge of consciousness, where it becomes kind of blurry. It's like how do you understand an idea? Like, can you ever understand an idea in a purest form? Like, is that even possible? And I don't really think it is at some level. Like, you just analogize further until you have some sort of blurry representation of the detailed specific one you're trying to figure out in the first place.
Yep. You just keep abstracting for me like a lower definition representation of it.
And that's kind of ties back into like what the Bibles were, what memes were over time. So they just kind of develop over time, and we refer to them, but we don't actually create them at any level. We just improve them and pass them along, sort of the way that nature selects the genes that survive there.
Yep. Just the same way that like these memes are surviving, so somebody like might make an edit, and then that edit is actually picked up by everybody, and then that becomes the new template, and then 6 months down the road somebody like makes a fork of that template because some new current event happened. The same thing, the same, like you can consider that like gerrymandering or whatever. The same gerrymandering effect might have occurred in the biblical stories. So
Where
yeah.
there's some sort of authority that's biasing it? Is that what you
It
mean?
doesn't even
Or.
have to be like a conscious authority. It doesn't even have to be like a room of full of people like orchestrating what stories get picked up and what stories don't. It could just be evolutionarily like some stories were more fascinating to some people. We might not have been writing these stories yet. They might have been oral myths for a long time, and then like a lot of people changed them, just like playing the telephone game. It's not because they were necessarily going to profit from changing them, but they could remember it easier whenever they fudged some facts, and then that's the version that got propagated.
Okay.
But it still
Yeah.
embodied like the same archetypal premise that the original say historically accurate one might have. So if Jesus were a historically accurate character, and I mean if he actually did exist, and if he actually really did embody this persona, then like we can interpret his things, or we can like write down what happened, but we probably don't understand that like, oh wow, he's embodying this archetype of like bearing the cross and all this different stuff. So we start telling these stories, and then like, yeah, the stories get diluted, but they still are a representation or an image of the archetype.
Right, and the fact that it's almost like a public ledger throughout society, like the fact that they're still being passed down today implies that they have some sort of weight that was applied to by the or
Right.
sort of defined by the consensus of people, that it was some sort of like somehow it rang true among a great number of people to the point that they felt like the next generation would also identify with this story. And so it's okay, that's starting to make sense. Yeah, because I'm thinking about just permutations of these strange memes that I see a lot of times, and one of the funniest ones, or not funniest, but one of just the most interesting ones that I've tried to analyze, and probably in vain, is the idea that like all memes have to have those the top and bottom text, or at least that's how they started, right?
Yeah.
And so now like you have a lot of memes that are just... Exactly, yeah. So in the I think it was Impact font, and so like I'm just thinking of the little baby, right, that's like doing the fist bump, and it's like, and so now you have like a lot of memes that are just other memes but pixelated, and then they just have like bottom text at the bottom, and so it's
it could be one of the meme categories could be like this kid with a top and bottom font, but you can abstract that to just an image with the top and bottom font, and that's another type of meme that is still replicating, is still prominent, and we found like specific variations of those that we like that include certain types of images, and then we allow permutations of the text. But that raw category seems to be a good mix of language and image in order to express some like common belief.
Exactly, yeah, and it's like every time a meme evolves, it's just like natural selection, right? So the meme itself selects the most popular version of what made it popular.
And looking back at like 2008, 2009 memes, like like 9 gags or stuff, they look so archaic, they look so old, they can't look like, how was I like following those?
You have like the cat with the like the chemistry one in the suit, and it's just like, I just remember my friends in at my high school, they were actually, they're the ones who got me into memes. Again, I don't want to use that term, but they
drugs.
But exactly, right? And so I was just thinking, like, this is so dumb. What is this? Like, it's just a picture. And they would always be like critiquing memes and analyzing them. And they're actually they're the reason I kind of got into it. And they were critiquing the ones back in like 2009, 2010. And I was like, what are they doing? And then over time, I was just like, okay, this is pretty funny. And then I, of course, fell into that hole in 2016 where everything was a meme, and every story that CNN tried to lob at Trump was either true in some form, but the fact that he embraced it itself just made it that much more hilarious, right? Yeah. And so,
I think one important thing to point out is that memes aren't new. Memes have existed for far longer than the internet. Things like wagons, fire, things that don't get passed along within our group through the genetic code get passed along through oral and memetics. So for instance, you see me using a wagon, you're part of a different village, you go tell your village about this wagon. Well, it's not like you inherited any of my genes or anything like that, but this idea was able to propagate, was able to replicate, and it's now able to reproduce itself, maybe even mutate itself amongst like this new population that it inhabits. So very much like when a virus infects a cell and it bonds to a cell and it begins to reproduce and mutate, we can think of what's happening when an idea infects us. And it begins to reproduce and it begins to mutate, and you start seeing permutations of it. Well, what happens in the biological world whenever a virus infects a cell is that you have an immune response to it. Well, the very same thing happens intellectually. You start building up an immune response to certain types of memes. And that's why when you see a meme that you've seen dozens of times, you've seen all the permutations of it, you no longer find it as amusing. You've sort of built up your own meme immune system.
Interesting. That's a really interesting analogy. I haven't heard that from anybody.
So memetic theory is still very controversial, as it's hard to define it. Like, I mean, we abstractly we can have these conversations, and it makes sense that of course we didn't just evolve to propagate our genes. We really care a lot about these ideas. Yeah, like I'll accept that premise. But it's hard to accept that premise and then design experiments to test that premise.
Yeah, okay, go ahead into that.
Yeah, so that I feel like that is something that should be addressed in order to be not seen as like an occult thing or like some weird YouTube thing, but actually a scientific thing. Yeah, like tied to 4chan. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I see.
So we really need to address the fact that like we haven't been able to design any tests to prove the idea like that we are attempting to propagate memes just as much as we are attempting to propagate genes.
Okay, I see. So we're not really aware of the control we have over them. But so I'm just wondering, I'm trying to apply this to like institutions. I'm taking that one step further. So I guess when you say that you're not supposed to try to interpret them or apply them or be able to measure them, does that also extend to institutions? So you should try to avoid trying to enact these kind of rules into law, kind of like what you have with compelled speech or even with the solution. Like, this is almost like a Marxist argument, right? Like, you're saying that nothing that you make is truly yours, right? It's all, you basically inherit it from everybody else around you.
You can study these ideas and you can figure out what is it that, like, drives certain behavior. You can figure out, and, like, the example here is Salvador Dali. He was a big fan of Freud, and he tried to use a lot of, I guess, manipulation would be the term, to, like, paint some things into his image or into his paintings that would create some sort of unconscious response from you. So people can use mimetics for dark power, for dark reasons. You can, we saw with the election of Trump, people were spreading misinformation with memes, and then that's actually what, like, we now claim that Russia did. We're like, oh, people were spreading these things on Facebook, that was misinformation, and people were sharing it because they looked just as real as everything else, and how do you know that this one's not real, or this one's not, how do you know that this one's less valid than anything else? There's this one campaign really highlighted, like, the dark side of the memes. It was fascinating to, like, watch happen in real time, but looking back, it seems so unreal. It was called Draft Our Daughters. So they would post images of, like, girls, like, in Girl Scout uniforms or just doing things, smiling, you know, and, like, the mom empowering the daughter, and they would say, like, it's her time, # draft our daughters, and they'd say, like, vote for Hillary at the bottom, and so people just started spreading these things. So people use mimetics to sort of, like, infiltrate the other side. So I start posting stuff now looking like I'm your ally, and then I just, like, start creating a slippery slope where, like, I suddenly am now, my whole argument is built on sand, because I let you infiltrate.
Yeah, you construct the straw man for them that you then present to your own side for them to just tear down ruthlessly.
Yep.
I get it. Yeah, because I remember this, like, it really showed because the right really responded in a way that was funny, because it's kind of funny to hear people claim that there weren't any fake news. Like, I know this is anecdote, right, but I personally saw a lot of fake news. Like, there was a lot of stuff that was just plainly wrong. And I still hear things today where, like, I find out that I've even been spreading misinformation. And it's like, ah, oh, damn. Like, okay, well, maybe this is actually real. But it's not like you can address it. And that was maybe tying into what my point was. It's like people are trying to solve these truths of human nature that they don't, that we can never understand. They're trying to affect them into law and affect them into our institutions. And I think that was kind of also, I mean, not to get too philosophical, but that could have been the foundation for why Marxism took root and then turned into postmodernism, if you follow that argument. Which I think can be attacked as well. Like, I know Peterson relies on that argument a lot, that postmodernism itself is some sort of form of Marxism.
But the same argument we made for the biblical stories, we now make for Marx. Why is it that his stories have stayed with us for so long? Is it just because we have, like, this utopian vision of a socialist world where we no longer have to work? Or is there something else? Is there some, like, psychological reason why these stories have been sticky and have been... We've been willing to test them out and enact corrupt versions of them and still talk about these ideas.
Yeah, so I think he really is making the same argument over time that we are. I mean, we're saying that ideas, or at least you're saying, you introduced me to this idea that ideas infect people, right? That people aren't really responsible for for their own behavior.
I actually really want to have this conversation with Justin, because I'm starting to believe his point. So I think Marx, I'm going to say some shit I probably will regret, but I think Marx is misrepresented a lot.
Yeah.
I think Marx was an intellectual. He wasn't an economist. There was no such thing as economists back then. He wasn't forming an economic theory. He wasn't trying to tell governments what monetary policy to enact. He was an intellectual talking about the scarcity of things, the reasons why... We exist under the systems that we exist, and then what happens whenever that premise is gone, what happens when scarcity is gone. So I think a lot of the people that I follow, they, like, oh, Marx didn't understand human nature, or Marx attributed to capitalism something that's true of human nature, that, like, there's not an even distribution of things that are the product of creativity. Things that are the product of creative efforts tend to follow the Pareto distribution. So for instance, like, whatever 20% of artists produce 80% of the art, is that the problem of capitalism? No. So the unjust dispersion of wealth within a society can't just be laid at the feet of the economic system that the society is enacting. So those are valid criticisms, but I think we really have to understand the fact that he wasn't trying to make an economic argument. He was just an intellectual. Those are two.
Yeah, he was. Arguments. I think he was definitely an intellectual, and I see him as more of a commentator on history. So he tries to understand how history works and what causes history to change and what causes our institutions to evolve over time. Like, what is the underlying factor? And he really, I think you're definitely right. I agree that he didn't sort of prescribe any of this activity, but he definitely laid the foundations for like the next step that's etched there to be like economic control and like seizure of that. I think the argument, I mean, it's kind of also a meme now, like the argument like, oh, it's just they didn't do it right. But it's like the fact that they definitely didn't do it right, because they didn't like achieve anything close to what he was even describing. I mean, he even himself said that utopia was basically impossible,
right?
And people were like, yeah, I'm going to do that now. You know, it says don't do that on page 8, but you know, I can make it happen. I think that's the main criticism of it.
Yeah, no,
but
people like, overall, wanted to see this utopia so bad, they were willing to burn the state, willing to end the world as they knew it. They were acting religiously. That's the funny part. They were, so just like maybe in the past, religious people who were looking forward to an apocalypse might have looked forward to it because they thought, hey, like hell was going to come on earth, but then after that there'd be a second coming and then we'd all exist in a perfect world. Well, that same naivety could be seen in these people enacting like socialist utopias, willing to destroy the state, willing to enact hell on earth, only for the simple like misillusion of like, oh yeah, but after all this we're going to end up in utopia. So it's very religious. They were acting religiously about it. They worship the state. They just, it doesn't matter if the gods are outside or inside, or they still believe in gods.
There's a kind of irony to that. Yeah, because he was, like you said, he was commenting on the fact that that does happen throughout society. And so it was the irony of that people took that and applied that sort of religious zealotry to it. It's like, he could probably like, oh man, like what are you guys doing? Yeah, because, I mean, he had a lot of fair criticisms, I think, about capitalism that he acknowledged couldn't be solved yet, that had to manifest themselves. And I think the fact that he is the one who identified them is why we attribute it to him. I mean, the fact that he was right is why he's so, I guess, study now. I really think he was the most important figure of the past couple centuries.
Yeah, but I think the left continues to be the left's inappropriate, immature behavior since like 2015. I don't know, maybe even before, but that's when I first started noticing it. Whenever Donald Trump first announced his campaign, I think that has maybe hurt Karl Marx's standing amongst like people in the center. People in the center start seeing people on the left acting like crazy and wearing these like sickle and hammer stuff, and now I don't want anything to do with that. So now like I might associate that with Marx, and I might think like, oh, this guy's a leftist, or this guy believes in like any sort of, or he's reading anything that's Karl Marx, like I'm automatically going to discount his opinion. And that's,
right, exactly.
That's one of the problems that we have to be careful with, like with this election. We don't have, I don't know, I feel like that could be, we could miss out on a lot that we still have yet to learn from Carl.
I think that's a really good point, because for a while he's been the perfect boogeyman for the right. Like the right has been able to take all of his really facile arguments that he really doesn't make.
Because he's a dead
make.
Boogeyman, because he can't speak
exactly.
Back.
They bundle him up into the villain that's really easy to lampoon, right, in the public square, and then left.
Nobody's willing
left
to defend
him. Like, exactly, and then I think that's ultimately what drove them, the leftists, into acceptance at some levels, because they see this right making a bunch of folly arguments about this historical figure without actually demonstrating proof or knowledge of any of the claims they're making, and so the leftists take that as kind of an onus to go actually set the record straight. And I really think. Then of course, now you like you say, starting about 2015, they started misappropriating his image in the same regard that we were, but the right was. I mean, I definitely had a period where I said, oh my gosh, Marxism, and you try it, fail it again. 100 million people died, et cetera. It's all his fault.
Right.
But it's really, you know, people attribute the hammer and sickle to him when that had nothing to do with him, right? That was,
right.
I mean, was that Lenin or is it Stalin that really made that? But regardless, it wasn't them, it was their personal adaptation of it.
Right.
So I think you're right. The message being, we have a lot to learn from Marx in the future, right?
I mean, humans, like absolute power corrupts absolutely. Like all these people in the position of power who are actually enacting the socialist utopia, how much of their motivation is an intellectual pursuit of enacting something that was described intellectually, and how much of it is a power move by them? How much is it like, oh yeah, let's dismantle the state, but just so long as I'm in charge. So, and then it's like a card you have in your back pocket, like just like to be Mao Zedong and be like, oh yeah, but like it's not my fault; it's socialism's fault.
Right, I guess so. Like deferring culpability, but also responsibility upon the collective.
So that kind of makes that makes that action a little more attractive to an actor. So, so now I'm some politician and I'm deciding what economic model to enact. So I'm like, I can do capitalism, or I can do whatever sort of variation of socialism that I want, and also have like this get out of jail free card. If it fails, I claim it wasn't my fault.
Yeah, exactly. You get to just say I'm not responsible for my actions, and I was born this way, as you know, people would use as an excuse. It's kind of almost hypocritical. I don't know where the definition of hypocrisy and irony kind of starts. It might be kind of right in the gray area there. But it's kind of funny anyway. At the very root, that the left and intersectionalists kind of use the hierarchical structures of the right that the right defines as order. Right, you're a member of your. They're just like flip. They think that you can apply Marx's, you know, flip everything on its head and apply it, and that's the solution to everything, right? And so now they're enforcing these super strict and ordered hierarchies where it's like, okay, well, if you're this ethnicity and this sexuality, that combines to form this privilege, and it's all super, you know, laid out, and do they want to put it into law? I just think that part is really funny.
Yeah, well, I mean, that tends to be a strategy that works in a lot of games that we participate in, like the inversion tactic. That's actually what Pepe is. Pepe is an inversion machine.
Really? Okay. In what way? That's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
Like turning around somebody's tool on themselves.
Exactly. You're calling me a racist. You're calling me a xenophobe. All right. I'll embrace it. I'll embody it in an image that I'll share with my friends. And so in that sense, I would say that he's an inversion machine. So some people do see a system that they are just repulsed by, and maybe they don't understand exactly why they're repulsed by it, but they unconsciously know that they want to destroy the system, and their first... sort of the simplest strategy that they might come up with is inverting the system.
Okay, I know that Alinsky touches on that. Alinsky's almost like the philosopher there that they get all their tactics from on left side. And I think that 2016 was definitely representative of a year when the right started learning how to be Alinskyite. You know, like you're talking about inversion. I think that's one of the key tactics of his rules. I don't remember all of them, but that's certainly one of them.
Right, his whole big...
the idea of using it against them.
His whole thing is like enact change from the inside.
Right, and it's almost like a Machiavellian way. Like you have to, at that level, you have to be aware of your surreptitious motives and what your actual intent is. So at that point, you don't get to defer the culpability, but you still do in public. But you just can never prove it, which I guess is the frustrating part. And I think this almost begs the question we were talking about earlier: like, at what level is the right responsible for fake news? Because Trump really just inverted that and pinned it on CNN and all those media groups. And really, it actually did start with like the actual right publishing fake news, right? Like, at what level does that belong to the right? Do you think?
Ooh, man, that's a good question. So let's see.
It's something that's painful to admit, but it's kind of true, right?
Yeah. So actually, I like posted a tweet about something similar to this earlier. So I was thinking about the fact that I'm seeing the media become more and more saturated with leftists. And I'm can't help but think this isn't going to be good for the Democrats. So the more people you have expressing like the anti-Trump opinion on the news, the less likely that the anti-Trump people are going to go out there and vote. They hear their opinion shared every day. Why should I go vote? Everybody else is saying this. So
and you think that could have played in with Hillary too?
Yeah, exactly. So it became saturated where like everybody is like believes the same shit. So now like I don't want to be a bad guy and believe the opposite of that shit. So I'm hearing this shit every day on the news, and now it's time to vote. Well, I'm not going to go vote because like y'all believe the same thing as me. Y'all are going to go vote, right? So it's tragedy of the commons in that like we like we defer the responsibility to somebody else, but that's only because of the fact that like you saturated the pool with everybody with like an echo chamber. Everybody was just uttering the exact same same exact news headlines or news analysis on the news headlines, same exact opinion. Everybody was like on the same side. Well, now nobody's actually motivated to go out and vote for that side because you've made me feel like you're already in charge. Why should I go vote for you?
Yeah, and I think you gave me this book back when I was in Austin, The Political Brain, I believe it's called, right?
Dude, that's so weird. I was just thinking about it like 15 minutes ago.
Yeah, and so like that what... So explain that argument. The argument is that the right is more susceptible to emotional arguments, the left is more susceptible to reason or uses that. And so, like, I was just thinking how that manifested with memes. Like, the emotional medium there is certainly the meme. And right. I think the left, the way they understood language was as a tool to change meaning. And so, like, what they reported, everything they reported was true in some light, but they could shape all the facts and display them in some certain order that made it seem like it was fake.
Yeah. So I don't know. The big thing about the right is that there's a narrative. So the left might have all the talking points, they might have all their facts straight, but what's the narrative? So like, you can give me a paragraph or maybe like 10 different bullet points that you want me to memorize, and then you might test me on it, and then you can give me the same 10 bullet points but give me a title. So where you're like, oh, okay, well, these are instructions on how to like change your oil or something like that. Well, now I'm a lot more likely to memorize it because I have the title. So once I form the narrative, once I like am able to abstract the thing that I'm doing to one single term, it becomes a lot easier for me to hold it in memory. So this book touches on the fact that we are the products of an evolutionary process. Our brain has evolved, so we like all the mechanisms we have in our brain didn't just come to be at the same time. So the logical core of our brain sits closer towards the center of our brain, closer towards our spinal cord, and the more emotional sector of our brain is like the prefrontal cortex, is at the very front of your brain. This is the part of your brain that is like most likely to be to be triggered by any like emotional response or any emotional okay. plea. This book tries to highlight the left versus the right in a very abstract way. I think it uses Bill Clinton as the example, but Bill Clinton ran a genius campaign when he ran for president, and it uses a lot of examples from his campaign strategy. So he ran a campaign unlike every other Democrat before him. I would say the only, like, Obama actually embraced a lot of the things that Clinton did. He actually did have a narrative. He had like the one word that he was trying to do. His word was hope, just like Obama's hope. He was like the man that looked presidential, and like he had a picture with JFK, and like that wasn't like a coincidence that he just dug up that picture. And then they used, from the very beginning, they seeded it. They like, the first thing I do when I announce my campaign, I'm going to show you that I'm from this town, Hope, Arkansas, and I'm the governor of Arkansas or whatever. And I'm going to show you this picture of me 12 years ago whenever I shook hands with JFK or whatever it was. And then like 3 years down the road, whenever I'm accused of sexual misconduct, well, like JFK was too, man. Like, we both look presidential, right?
So that's the same argument of Obama being really, resourceful and diligent by announcing his use of cocaine prior to even starting his political life. I mean, I don't want to give him too much credit. I personally think Obama's one of the best politicians definitely. Ever in American history. I mean, like, talk about a guy who's purely motivated by, like you said, a narrative. I mean, he really was only motivated by enacting his agenda. And I got to give respect where it's due, right?
Not a lot of people can do that. The way he's responding to, like, his legacy being destroyed?
Yeah. It's like, so funny. Man. Yeah, I mean, that's basically, like, the narrative. It's funny. I don't know if the people that publish these stories where it's like, oh, my gosh, Trump is dismantling Obama's Obama's legacy. They print that. Do they know that that's exactly why people voted for Trump?
Yep.
Like, when they see
no,
it,
they don't.
Like confirming that echoes.
They don't. That's why Trump won, because they don't understand America, because these are coastal elites who are writing every single news article that we're reading, and they think that they're able to represent what an American thinks. These people are in touch with the average American, and that's what 2016 was all about. Was like, yeah, shaking up the coastal elites, letting them know, like, yeah, well, we still vote, we still show up. You talk, you retweet all your bullshit or whatever, kick me off Twitter, but at the end of the day, we show up to vote.
Yeah, and like the common argument I hear, like at least the initial reaction of people who haven't really read the book, myself included, I haven't read it yet, unfortunately, but it's definitely on the list. But the book Political Brain is that, well, no, that's the flip, right? Republicans are the ones who use logic. Democrats are all emotional. And I think that the answer to that is really, well, the left has become so infatuated with intellectualism and the idea that you can use reason to solve anything that it's almost kind of like around and cycled back on itself.
Yeah, right? No, you're right. I mean, it's like the Hegel dialectic shit moves like a pendulum. It swings from one extreme to the next. That's the only way progress is done. Progress isn't done in a linear one, like plus one, plus one, plus one. Progress is done from like, let's hold this extreme idea. Well, shit, that didn't work. Let's hold this extreme idea.
Yeah, exactly. Like the combination of thesis and antithesis.
Right. So I don't think we can attribute to like, hey, the Republicans are the ones with logic, or it's actually the Democrats. That thing is going to change which party is using it as logic. But I think this. I do want to get. Okay. So you talked a little bit about. Okay. So the left. I want to get back to like the inversion thing. So the left has inverted in the fact that they. I feel like a lot of their action comes from the fact that they have like an utter disgust for anything that's like orthodox and like any innate traditions. So the left really like looks down on fundamentalist Christians, and it thinks all Christians are like fundamentalists, and it thinks all Christians are creationists, and they have like a very very low definition image of a Christian. And the irony of that is that the left is now the one that's holding sacred arguments that they're not even willing to converse about. So you're no longer listening on the news and like listening to like people talk about, okay, here's the pros and here's the cons of immigration, or here's the pros and here's the cons of DACA. No, DACA is something that's sacred and we cannot talk about. So let's move on to the next argument. So it has, because of that, because they've inverted and because of like their disgust for Christianity and these things, they started like moving away from this policy based on facts that actually made sense, but maybe like we weren't able to summarize nicely, to hey, instead let's just summarize it nicely and like let's not contest these little points.
Okay, so if I'm following correctly, what you're saying is that the left has this sort of like fundamental loathing for even the concept of archetypes and the fact that they're true, and that they want to, because I remember the idea of classical liberalism is that human nature is essentially good, but I think that manifested, or at least morphed over time into something that, like the idea that humans are shaped by the societal constructs around them, and so that kind of leads to the idea that humans can also be in control of themselves, or at least in control of others and how they manipulate the environments in which they live. And so taking that to the extreme, you could say that the left has really fallen into its own archetype of trying to sever the archetypes. And so if that makes sense, like, is right. that just a
I mean, there's a real reason for the left to exist. It's because there is a lot mm-hmm. of injustice in the world, and there does need exactly. to be a champion for the little guy. But then people tend to take advantage of the position of being the guy who gets to speak for the little guy. Well, hey, this little guy's not actually like looking at the bills. Let me like start increasing this and fudging the numbers here and there. So it is likely, just like the right is likely to corrupt, the left is just as prone to corruption, because it's foundationally built to speak for the man who doesn't have a voice.
I see. Okay. And I definitely agree. Like, there's a lot of areas where that's required, but it's almost like they go too far. Like, I think with one telling philosophy where it showed kind of Hillary's lack of philosophy and what really distinguished her from Obama, at least separated them into polar opposite camps, was when she said, she just flips on the wind. That's what I'm referring to. But in one of the debates, she was talking about nominating Supreme Court justice. And she said, what's the role of Supreme Court? And she said, to protect the little men from giant corporations. And it's like, well, yes, at some level, but that's not the only prerogative, right? You have to also protect giant corporations from the majority.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Because like, I think the founders definitely knew that there was always going to be this eternal battle between these factions. And the bigger the factions are, the more likely they are also to try right. to impose onto the majority, but also be imposed on by the majority.
But the hot thing right now, right, is like defend the little guy. So I'm not going to worry about right. like, that's what the Supreme Court is for now. That's like the only utility I have for it now. And then like these other things that it might have been good for in the past, like defending the Constitution. Well, the Constitution is the embodiment of tradition, and we are disgusted by tradition and orthodoxy, so yeah, we're definitely not going to try to defend that.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's really, you really see it every day in their actions. I mean,
but it's not, I, like, I really do think it's not like they're conscious of these motivations. That's the whole reason we went into the psychoanalyst stuff. So it's like I'm motivated okay. by all these things, but I don't understand my own motivations. So I might be able to, like, on the outside, be sitting here and looking at the political landscape and, like, infer all these motivations. But that doesn't mean that these things were orchestrated. That doesn't mean, like, the left suddenly decided, like, hey, let's invert. Let's suddenly start doing this, or let's do that. Like, these decisions are made evolutionarily. They're made by individuals, not necessarily, like, in a coordinated manner. It's not like the left is, like, a monolithic entity. It's, like, just like the alt-right. So the alt-right is trying to be, people try to paint it as like a monolithic entity that like there is one alt-right and there's not like all these different factions of it. Well, the same is true about the left. There's not just one left.
Yeah, I think this is where I agree where with what Justin said earlier about the idea of being a spectrum, just being continuous on every level. That's how I definitely view the political spectrum, that on some level there is like a fundamental difference that you can really kind of jump into one of two categories. I think that's useful, but at the end of the day there's really no like the one category that defines everybody, and you can't just encompass such a wide range of views into one spectrum.
Yep.
I see a lot of memes about how the left kind of got it wrong about the gender spectrum being continuous and fluid and the political spectrum being binary. It really is the other way around, right? I mean, it's another fundamental truth that's kind of expressed in comedic.
Yeah, but so the left is built to be the champion for the little guy. So there is gender dysphoria. There are cases where whatever reason I'm born hermaphrodite or whatever it is. So these guys are minorities, just by definition. So somebody has to step up to defend them. So the left comes up to defend them, and the easiest way to defend them is to say like, oh, actually we're all on a spectrum. Nobody's all gay or all straight. We're all on a spectrum. And then, so I see that natural, like breaking away from the binary, that I see that occurring naturally just as a result of the fact that the left is the champion of the little guy.
That's interesting. I think that's probably pretty spot on. So what then, of course, like how does this ramify into the future then? Because if we can't operate on the same level of facts, of factual analysis, then like what happens? That's really bad, right? It's a harbinger of chaos in the future.
Okay, so I think a good way to understand this, so I just finished my last college exam. It was a game theory exam.
Congratulations.
There's this notion in game theory of level N players. Actually, I have my notes right here. Like, I don't want to butcher this. Pull this out. But essentially, there's different levels of players. So in game theory, we can conceptualize any sort of like dance or anything that two players or multiple players are participating in as a game. So it's not like literally a game, but it could be like a car salesman trying to sell you something. You can conceptualize that as a game, and then there's utility in conceptualizing it as a game. And this notion of level N players is that there are different strategy sets for different types of games. And some players are smarter than others. But, like, we don't use the term smarter, but some players are a higher level than other players. So, for instance, say that we're playing a game where there's, like, 10 outcomes. The level 1 player would play his strategy profile would be, like, even distribution amongst those 10. So it would be, like, a 1 in 10 of picking one of these cards. A level 2 player knows that the level 1 player is likely to have an even distribution, so he plays the best response to the level 1 player. So he's no longer playing like an even distribution, but he's playing a strategy based on the fact that he thinks a lot of people play this even distribution. So I see that same analogy extending over here. So I see us understanding memes, and then I see us understanding, oh, some people are able to use these memes, and then he can take it even further. It's like, okay, well, you're the level N player. You're able to have a strategy profile that, like, that is the best response to somebody else's best response.
Okay, I see. I think I understand that example. I've heard one in one of my classes that's kind of similar, and it's the idea that you have a group of people in the room that are trying to all pick a number between 1 and 100. Have you heard? Are you familiar with this? The way this is going?
No.
And they all try to. They pick a number, and there are players that assume that it's going to be near the middle, right?
Yes.
Because they assume everybody, like you said, the even distribution, so they pick 50, but then there are people that are aware of that.
Exactly,
and so they
try to
pick closer to the extremes.
Yeah, so I either try to pick closer to the extremes, or I try to pick a number that like is hard to guess, because I think that you're likely to trick me.
And so taking that to another level, when everybody's operating on different strategies or different sets of rules for their games, does that mean that in the end it does produce something that at least looks like the appearance of true randomness and chaos? And so that really is what happens, or is there always a way to analyze the input types of a group and expect the output that's going to come when they operate together on the same field?
Ooh, I think there's always a way to like retrospectively rationalize why we ended up there, if we ended up there. If it's a true equilibrium, if it's not just a temporary resting spot and then it moves on, if it's a true equilibrium, then like there should be some rationalization for why we ended up there.
Okay, so like, yeah, because my operating it as somebody who programs a lot, I kind of have been biased by the worldview that true randomness is impossible, right? Like, you have, like, the source of randomness on computers just comes from a big file that randomly inputs your random keystrokes and mouse movements, and that's where it gets the random values from. So, like, I don't know, what's your opinion on that? Do you think that randomness truly is possible, or is it just some sort of thing that we can always abstract or analogize to but never actually reach?
I feel like true randomness is impossible. I feel like it has to be seeded from something, and then we could reproduce the steps it took to get there. So unless there's some crazy like one-way function that I don't understand that is able to like produce like all the circuits in the computer are logical circuits. They produce like logical outcomes. So how can we have like an illogical random outcome as a result of logical mechanisms?
Exactly. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, I tend to agree with that.
Yeah. So like if all my computer can do is like plus one minus one times one divided by one, then like how can I ever have and if I'm watching this computer and I'm able to see exactly what circuits are firing, how could I ever have a random thing?
So that function you were alluding to, is that kind of like the idea of like an arrow of time, like the direction of time is in one way, like entropy in this law of thermodynamics, what Stephen Hawking talks about?
Yeah, I was thinking like if there's a black box that just like pumps out a number, it might be good enough. It might be like pseudo-random. It might be random enough for me to treat it like it's random, like it's truly random.
Okay.
But if it's not a black box and I'm able to actually like study how this number is being produced and how we're arriving to this number, well then that's not random. I can break it and predict the next one.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know if this is a correct interpretation of A Brief History of Time, because I don't know if he's kind of changed in some of his opinions since writing that, because that was a while ago, but he talks about this arrow of time being like the only source of, not misinformation, but the only lack of information. It exists either at the Big Bang, so anything before that, there's no way we could possibly ever know that,
right?
And then inside black holes, and so like the destruction of information, and it's almost like that could be the path of randomness, but even just by finding out, it wouldn't be random anymore, because you'd be able to interpret what produced it in order to see the result, I guess.
Yep.
So like,
no, I really don't know enough about black holes to talk about. Yeah. I mean, I know that like the second law of thermodynamics is that like entropy is always increasing, and entropy is like this weird way we use to measure uncertainty and confusion. So, for instance, like a pool. If I've got a bathtub full of water, there's only two things that I can measure, is like the volume and the temperature. And every single molecule has its position, and I could quantify its position, but it's very difficult to quantify the position of every single particle. So the difficulty is conceptualized as entropy. So for instance, fire is a lot more particles, or it's moving a lot. It's a lot harder to actually measure what the position of every independent particle is. So it has a higher degree of entropy. So the things with more disarray have higher degrees of entropy. So we want things with less entropy whenever we're building like a mechanical engine or something like that. We don't want it to give out off heat, because something with really high entropy is very hard to convert into mechanical utility. So that's the second law of thermodynamics, that entropy is always increasing. And then Hawkins got really famous for suggesting that information is actually so in your computer, when you erase something, we're not just destroying information. Information is never destroyed. It's like preservation of energy. Like, energy is never destroyed. It's converted into something else. Information, like, just like we said, genes and memes, well, there's information and energy. It's the same thing. So information is never destroyed. So what that means when I'm erasing something on my computer is my computer is outputting heat. Heat is this high energy thing that is produced as a result of it. So Hawkins had this theory. And I'm kind of like reaching like the limitations of my understanding here, but essentially that information could fall into a black hole and actually be destroyed, and the smallest unit of information you can send would be like a photon. So you can send a photon into a black hole, and I really don't understand exactly the dynamics of a black hole, like, because the dynamics depend a lot on perspective. So from the perspective of the photon actually never hits the black hole. So from the photon's perspective, it's like, oh, I'm constantly going straight. Shit looks crazy, yeah, but I like, shit's fine for me. But from an outsider's perspective, me looking in to see if that photon's all right, all I see is radiation coming back, the exact same amount of radiation that that photon put in. So I see this, I put in something of 1x, and I see 1x radiation come out, and I'm like, okay, well, that thing was destroyed, that thing was been radiated out. But from the perspective it was only my observation of it that collapsed this probability distribution to a single state that is now, like, now it's been radiated and destroyed. So it's, I think it's still a contested field in physics if information can be destroyed. I don't think there's a clear...
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's really relatively said to the perspective. I mean, you kind of touched on something that I definitely believe to be true about myself. It's like the more I'm trying to become interested, or I'm trying to read more about like physics and cosmology and, I guess, quantum mechanics, but it's really easy to just read it and pretend like you have an understanding of it. I think that's a trap I got to avoid. Like, I read it, I'm like, okay, well, this makes zero sense, but, I mean, I guess I have all these fancy terms to relate them to each other, right? So, I mean, as far as, yeah, like... Because it really does depend on perspective. Because, like you said, red shifts out like when a photon goes through. But the idea of perspective from photon, is that even possible, right? Because it's moving at the speed of light, and so there's no measurable time in the perspective of a photon. Yep. So there's not really any before or after, because everything's on it. I mean, the famous example he used in his work, Stephen Hawking did, was the idea of a light cone, and the light cone being this, like the edges of a light cone being the separation between what's always predetermined and happening to the unknown and what can never be possible with the current state of the universe. And so I don't know how he applied that to entropy, is that there's some, that the grand question out there that we want to solve is there a direction to the era of time,
right?
Or the one, or that we observe, like, why is there a direction? Exactly. And I believe there are three directions. There's entropy, then there was the human experience, and right. Then what else was there? I think the expansion of the universe was the third one.
I mean, so like, we have this law of thermodynamics that, like, entropy is always increasing, but that might just be that. So, like, we can only get our energy from how can I word this? So we can only experience time in one direction, like this arrow of time, because we're prone to this limitation of entropy being a one-way function, of entropy only moving in one direction. So we can only get our energy from things that are moving up in entropy, not moving down. So we can't experience time backwards. If we were able to exist somewhere where entropy were a decreasing function, well then, yeah, you could theoretically go backwards in time. But if you can't exist somewhere where entropy can move backwards, well then how can you ever move backwards in time?
Exactly, because it's at some level, even if you are moving backwards, even if you accomplish the opposite of entropy, that's still not, it's only backward relative to what we experience now. So, like, that's the deeper question, I think, is there only one direction that you can operate in, right, when you're operating within some sort of predefined state of the universe? And I don't know, what I really think is kind of like the synthesis between Peterson's idea, conceptualization of the universe and existence, and what he calls, I think, being. As like a yin yang, right, between chaos and order. I think the reason I think that's so profound is because that's my interpretation of cosmology and physics and existence in the scientific realm, is that this small pocket of disarray inside this otherwise homogeneous bubble bursts into the Big Bang, and it was that those specific area of those specific areas of discord is what manifested into the stars and planets and elements, right? It was only because there was
that makes, like, perfect sense, and that can help explain why this image of the yin yang has stayed with us forever. Well, because it expresses this truth that is actually a cosmological truth, not just a human nature truth. It tells a lot of truth in a simple image with just two colors, that, like, hey, in perfect order chaos can emerge, and in perfect chaos order can emerge, and the ideal mode of being is somewhere in between those two.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because, like, the yin-yang is something that I've always liked, but I've never fully understood until, right, or at least partially understood until recently, right? And so I'm like, why have I always known that this means what I didn't know it
exactly,
meant?
Exactly, because
the whole time,
only,
like, 1%
at a more abstract
of
your intelligence
level
is this articulated wisdom. 99% of your intelligence is things outside of the prefrontal cortex. And like, you recognize this image, this, like, part of you knows what, like, oh, damn, that's telling me the truth, but, like, you haven't articulated why.
I'm just wondering if that's where the meme comes from, where you only use 10% of your brain. I'm pretty sure that, like, I mean, yeah, I guess so. But explain what you mean about the 1%. So only 1% of the processes in our brain are used to articulate and process information? Or
yeah, it's like, what is that? Exactly. They try to take, like, the fact that, like, hey, look at how many, like, neural networks are fired whenever, like, you start using language pathways. And look at how many neural networks there are. Like, such a small number of them are delegated for, like, this this language functionality and like this rationality, because rationality and everything else is sort of a subset of language. So if like our total set of tools that we have, if only a subset of them are used for this, well then we must have a lot more intelligence. We just can't express it.
I see. Okay, so that's really what, and then Justin was kind of hitting on that point last episode, right? I think you made a good point about separating the human mind, the rational mind, that's always trying to outweigh
right.
its own processes above the ones of the internal gut emotional state that you experience, that really considers a lot more factors. I think that was kind of elucidated for me personally. I'd never really thought of it like that. But yeah, it's kind of true. It's like, why does your gut always tell you something different than the logical processes that you think you're in control of, right? Is it perhaps that something else has considered this with more gravity than you have?
Yep.
It's an interesting way, yeah. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on? I know this has been pretty extensive so far, at least.
Let's see. So in short, we're constantly acting out truths that we do not have like articulated to ourselves, that, so we don't even know our own motivations. Some other bullet points I wrote down. Every time you go see a movie, you're participating in the process through which the truly unknown gets articulated and begins to get replicated. A real artist is someone expressing what has not yet been expressed. And human culture is the medium, source, and power that makes this evolutionary process of ideas possible.
Okay, so there's some pretty... weightful topic. So is that really that? This is what kind of begs the question for me, at least in, from my perspective, is that is this idea that we have this external consciousness? I don't want to use consciousness because that term's overused, but this external function that's moving alongside society and processing in sort of evolutionary processing this sort of set of ideas separate from our own conscious thoughts. Is that indicative of some higher distinction that humans possess that really does make us special? Like, I think this idea that humans are not special is something that can be proven in many different ways, but it also is really dangerous idea, for the it politically. Yeah.
I agree.
So, I mean, that's really the question, yeah.
I don't think I've got a good answer for that one.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely gone past the extent of my actual confirmed knowledge of this, awesome. Of memetics, so it's something you can always learn about. I mean, it's always changing by definition.
Yeah.
Always evolving.
We should have Justin on the next one.
Yeah, I definitely think that it'd be good to have a good conversation, either with just y'all too, so I'm not there to inhibit it with my delayed understanding, right?
No, it's good. That's
that's
why Joe Rogan's podcast is so popular. It's like you need somebody in the room who isn't an expert in this field so that he can ask the questions that nobody else would ask.
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to do, at least moving forward, is try to get people that can understand the things that I'm trying to understand, because I don't want to claim to profess interior knowledge of all this stuff, because it's so complicated, right? So, I guess that really wraps it up pretty well. I mean, you have anything else to add?
No, that's about it.
Cool. Yeah, well, thanks again to Enrique Sotomayor. You want to go into kind of the projects that you're doing real fast before we wrap it up? Uh-huh. So there's Atlas, which is in its final stages of development.
Yeah, so Atlas is this app Atlas is this app that we're building at Cryptoconomy, and we're really trying to solve one of the problems that a lot of people are trying to solve in the cryptocurrency world, is that there's a fragmentation at the exchange level. If you want to buy the coins that everybody's talking about, you probably have to have multiple exchange accounts. And because of that, there's a real need for portfolio managers, something that tells you the value of your portfolio in real time. There's a lot of apps out there, Delta, Blockfolio, CoinStats, CoinPair, all these different things. We're doing the same thing as that in the sense that we're telling you the value of your portfolio in real time. Unlike those other apps, we're totally free. We're on the cloud, so you can access your portfolio, not like your actual Bitcoin or your actual Ethereum, but just the database that says how much it's worth in real time. You can access that from multiple devices. But the real unique thing we're doing with Atlas is we're launching what we're calling Crypto Fantasy. So it's paper trading competitions. It's a mix of Investopedia and DraftKings. So we can start a league, for instance, and set the rules. So we can say, hey, everybody starts off with $100,000, but you're limited to Bitcoin and Ethereum only. You're limited to one trade per day. And whoever has the highest balance at the end of the month wins. So you can start these little crypto fantasy scenarios, and you can start as many games as you want. They could be private games or public games. And you can also make them paid games. So you can say, hey, it costs $10 to enter this game. Everybody starts off with $1 million. Whoever makes the most money wins the whole pot. So they're a way to sort of hedge ourselves. So we don't want So, by making it a paper trading thing, people can make money even though the markets are all down, as long as you're picking the one, as long as you're winning your game, right? Because this is a relative competition. This is not absolute. So that was the
Right,
whole.
so at some level you're just deferring authority to people who know what they're doing, which is a really good way to get novices into turn them into professionals, right? In an area that a lot of people don't know much about,
Yep, so that's something we're
being
trying to do. We're
cryptocurrency
trying
trading.
to we're tailoring this app towards the tail ends of the distribution. So we're targeting the guy who's never moved in crypto but has heard the buzzword 1,000 times. At the same time, we're targeting
Okay.
the day trader who has experience. So we want the day trader to come on board because he's going to win at the games and he's going to beat everybody else at the crypto fantasy and he's going to win the pot, basically. And then we want him to come on board so that people can click on his profile and view his trades and follow him and maybe start copying some of his strategies in real life.
Okay, yeah, I really like that idea. I mean, you bring up Market Watch. That was actually how I guess discovered, not really discovered, but learned, or at least took the first step into securities trading, just because otherwise I had no idea how any of it worked.
Yep.
And so providing that for the crypto
And there's a
kind of
reason
side of things seems
that
to
they
be,
develop
yeah.
these tools. There's a reason that Forex traders all or Forex websites always have paper trading. It's because it lets you get your toes wet. It lets you realize, like, damn, I could actually make money. Let me actually put my dad's credit card on here now. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to do something that lets people feel a little more comfortable with cryptos, makes them more familiar with them, gives them room to simulate it. And then if they want to actually be invested in it going forward, then we want to give them resources to learn about these different crypto assets.
Awesome, yeah, that's a pretty thorough description, and that should be that's really close to on its way soon. So what you've shown me so far has been really cool looking, so looking forward to that, to seeing that soon. And if you have any suggestions or thoughts on the episode, please do email us. We'll try to get back to you. We appreciate all feedback. So
And
with
hit
that,
the
hope you
subscribe
guys have a good day, Enrique.
button.
Yeah, definitely hit that subscribe button. Just pull up Ben Shapiro, and
Yeah.
my wife's a doctor, we'll do
My wife's a doctor
it.
too.
Thanks again for yeah. Promulgate, right? You got to promulgate that information. But anyway, thanks for tuning in. Thanks, Enrique, for keeping that episode on the ground. Appreciate
Sounds good.
it.
Bye-bye.
Bye.